Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Virginia Sacchetti of the South African Anti-Privatization Forum, who criticizes the World Bank and International Monetary Fund's policies toward impoverished nations. Terry Jones, a founding member of the Monty Python comedy troupe, who explains why he believes that policies followed by President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair in the War on Terror have made the world a more dangerous place. And Sister Helen Prejean, one of the country's most passionate opponents of the death penalty, who recounts how she came to be a leader of the national campaign to abolish capital punishment. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In October 2004, Washington, D.C. District Court Judge Emmett G. Sullivan, in response to a lawsuit filed by six John Doe soldiers, effectively banned the anthrax vaccine immunization program, stating the process that allowed the required vaccine to be licensed in the first place was unlawful. However, in December, the Pentagon obtained an emergency authorization to resume the vaccine program for military personnel on a voluntary basis. This was the first time a provision of the Project BioShield Act, a law passed 3 years after the 9/11 attacks, had been invoked. Since early April, Judge Sullivan had allowed the Pentagon to continue the vaccine program on the condition that it must remain voluntary. The anthrax vaccination program, mandatory since 1998, has administered inoculations to 1.1 million soldiers in a six-shot anti-anthrax regimen for protection against the so-called inhalation anthrax. Hundreds of soldiers who refused the vaccine have been kicked out of the military. Navy veteran Jesse Kearns received the vaccine in 2000 as part of his deployment to the Persian Gulf. Since then, 25-year-old Kearns has suffered two heart attacks, blood clots, and a stroke that has left him with a limp. A Long Island resident, Kearns must now get by on $300 a month in disability pay. According to the Village Voice, critics charge that the side effects of the vaccine can be severe, including death, and the number of soldiers who have become ill is significant. The 15-year career of Arizona Sheriff Samuel Powers ended the day he was shot during a training exercise with the M26 Taser, a stun gun with 50,000 volts of electricity. The so-called non-lethal stun gun is growing in popularity with many police departments, with as many as 100,000 police officers carrying tasers. Yet, increasingly, some law enforcement professionals worry about the unknown risks of the high-powered stun gun made by Arizona-based Taser International. During the taser exercise, Powers fell over in intense pain as the weapon's electrodes were attached to his shoulder and ankle. He was struggling to breathe with massive pain in his back and chest. As he recalled, "It was the worst pain I felt in my life." According to Amnesty International, over 90 people in the US and Canada have died after being shot with a taser, mostly due to complications from heart attacks, drug intoxication, or asphyxiation. In 80% of the cases, the suspect was not armed, and in a third of the cases, police used the stun gun to control verbal compliance. Amnesty International has called for a moratorium on the use of the taser, citing the lack of independent research on the stun gun and the health impact of its increased use. Former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, a prospective 2008 presidential contender, has merged his operations with the powerful Texas law firm Bracewell & Patterson, who have strong ties with the energy industry and the Bush White House. The new law firm, Bracewell & Giuliani, has a blue-chip client list that includes Enron, ExxonMobil, Pacific Gas & Electric, and Dynegy. It has also represented major firms in healthcare, telecommunications, and emerging technology. Over the years, the law firm's reputation has been made defending the most powerful corporations in the energy industry. According to The Grist, an online environmental magazine, Giuliani will open the firm's first New York office. In recent years, the former mayor, through his consulting company, Giuliani Partners, has worked for Entergy Nuclear Northeast to beef up security at New York area nuclear power plants, and for TransCanada and Shell to create support for building a liquefied natural gas facility on Long Island Sound, a project bitterly opposed by conservationists. Many environmentalists say the move by Giuliani to team up with Texas energy interests is designed to help him raise the millions of dollars he needs for the 2008 presidential campaign. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
Five years ago, tens of thousands of demonstrators staged militant protests in Washington, D.C. to oppose the policies of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund toward impoverished nations while demanding the cancellation of crippling debt. Although the giant financial institutions have adopted some of the rhetoric of global social justice activists in the intervening years, they have not altered their neoliberal economic model of privatization and free trade. While fewer in number, protesters in Washington again this year expressed anger and dissatisfaction with the bank's policies, sentiments shared by millions in the developing world. During their spring meeting in Washington, delegates to the World Bank and IMF failed to reach agreement on canceling the debt of poor countries and increasing aid directed toward their people. Among those inside and outside the World Bank, there is growing concern that the goal established 5 years ago to reduce global poverty by 2015 could be undermined by right-wing ideologue and Iraq War architect Paul Wolfowitz, named by President Bush to become the bank's next president. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Virginia Setshedi of the Anti-Privatization Forum based in Johannesburg, South Africa, a group that assists poor residents in Soweto to restore water and electricity service shut off by private utilities. Setshedi, who was in Washington to speak out during the meetings, explains why she is critical of World Bank IMF development policies and her concern about the bank's future under the direction of its new president, Paul Wolfowitz.
Aid comes with lots of, you know, problems, and the developing countries tend to use aid as a tool of dominating the underdeveloped countries. So our call is for the banks to cancel the debt, and because most of the monies that are supposed to be taking care of our people in our countries are being taken to pay this debt that doesn't end. Most of the countries are being forced to pay the illegitimate debt. Where, for instance, in South Africa, as you know, we had apartheid for many years, and the apartheid government took these loans, and the money that was taken from these loans was used into buying arms and bullets to kill our people. And now the call that we're making in our country is that this debt is a legitimate or it's an odious debt, therefore our countries are not supposed to pay it. So those things have never been spoken about in this meeting.
What is the obstacle, in your view, to making a decision among these wealthy nations to eliminate the debt that really creates huge problems in terms of just basic social welfare in the nations that must pay these debts back?
I think it goes back to the nature of the bank itself or the financial institutions. What are they for? Are they still performing what they were initially established for, and in what context are they operating? And it has been clear that they are operating in the context of neoliberal paradigm, which forces countries to follow this trend, which is enforcing, you know, the capitalist principles and making sure that the poorer get poorer and the richer get richer, and which is the case with the countries as well. You know, we see poor countries becoming more poor and while rich countries are becoming richer.
Virginia, what's the role of the United States and the Bush administration, in your view, for eliminating the debt on the poorest countries as well as increasing the aid? The United States really stands at the lowest level in terms of a percentage of its GDP that it devotes to assisting poor nations.
I think, you know, the role of the United States has been a negative role, and we see it especially in, like when Bush visited our country, Africa, last year, you know, he didn't say anything about issues around debt. but he said something about AIDS, but it's not also not clear how is he going on with it. But also sort of using our president, especially President Mbeki, to be his instrument to enforce his imperialist ideas around Africa. And he even said, you know, Thabo Mbeki is my point man in Africa, so he is a boy that he's confident that he's doing his job in Africa.
Virginia, what are some of your concerns about the installation of Paul Wolfowitz, an architect of the Iraq War, formerly Deputy Defense Secretary of the Pentagon? What's your concern about what he'll do as president of the World Bank?
No, my minor concerns will be, does he know anything about development? Because, I mean, the bank is a development bank. But also, for me, his nomination, you know, brings a very good opportunity, especially for us in the social movement and in the anti-war movement, to show that there's no difference between war and imperialism and the World Bank itself. And Wolfowitz, you know, as we know, his background in the Pentagon now will play the role that he played before within the bank. And then what we need as social movements and is to sort of like link these issues and make our struggle strong in making sure that we deal with issues around war, imperialism, and development, and poverty, and so forth.
Maybe you could briefly state what you think that link is between the operations of the World Bank, the neoliberal economic policies, and the unilateral military policies of the Bush administration.
You know, like after the war in Iraq, those contracts that companies like Halliburton got in Iraq, and those contracts were sort of like pushed by Wolfowitz himself. And now the World Bank will also play a role in making sure that those contracts are being enforced, and it's not going to only be in Iraq and, you know, all over the world if possible. And Wolfowitz, as someone who can make decisions like invasion of Iraq, can also, you know, make decisions around how to deal with poverty. But we don't think that his decisions on dealing with poverty in the third world will be what we're looking for as the activists in those countries, because he'll be sort of like enforcing the Bush administration ideas and the principles around dominating these third world countries.
That was Virginia Setshetty of the Anti-Privatization Forum, based in Johannesburg, South Africa. She also serves on the board of the 50 Years is Enough Network. Contact the network at area code 202-IMF-BANK or visit their website at www.50years.org. Visit the Anti-Privatization Forum's website at www.apf.org.za. As the daily attacks on U.S. forces and their allies in Iraq step up after a post-election lull, increasing numbers of citizens are becoming skeptical of a White House forecast for stability and a reduction in the number of American troops in the occupied nation. With suicide bombings and kidnappings an almost daily occurrence, few Western journalists dare to venture very far from their hotels in the green security zone in Baghdad to report on the war. And as the U.S. military switches from offensive operations to training members of the Iraqi police and military, insurgents have also changed their tactics, targeting and killing large numbers of these forces. The situation for civilians has also continued to deteriorate. The United Nations Human Rights Commission in Geneva recently reported that the number of Iraqi children suffering from malnutrition has doubled since the U.S. invasion toppled the government of Saddam Hussein in 2003. Terry Jones, one of the founding members of the Monty Python comedy troupe, has since September 11th been writing columns in the British press highly critical of George Bush and Tony Blair's militaristic policies in the Middle East. His essays, laced with irony and humor, have now been published in the U.S. under the title Terry Jones's War on the War on Terror, Observations and Denunciations by a Founding Member of Monty Python. Reached by phone in London, Between the Lines Scott Harris spoke with Jones about why he feels that the Bush-Blair policies have made the world a more dangerous place.
You know, after 9/11, it seemed like our great leaders said all the right things, but did all the absolutely the wrong things. It seemed like, you know, every action they took seemed to be guaranteed to have the opposite result of what they said it was going to have. And they just did like, for example, Tony Blair saying he's going to make England safe from terrorist attack. Well, England wasn't under any terrorist threat. The IRA had stopped bombing us. We didn't have any. There was no reason to be scared of Muslim fundamentalists. We got along with the Islamic people in England fine. There was no threat. The only threat came when he started joining America and bombing a country that had never even threatened us. That was what was so one of the things so baffling. But after 9/11, for example, George Bush, said all the right things. He said, "Well, we've got to catch the evil perpetrators of this evil deed." So I guess what you would do in that case is you'd rely on secrecy and speed and catch them by surprise. What you don't do is announce where you're going to look for them. "We're going to look for you in Afghanistan." "When are you going to do it?" "In 2 weeks' time." "And then what are you going to do to them?" "We're going to bomb you." Like, in 2 weeks' time, there's not going to be a single perpetrator of an evil deed left in Afghanistan. They're not going to catch. It's like playing hide and seek, not like catching a criminal.
So all the things they did, you think, will backfire on this country and your nation, Britain?
Oh, I think so, absolutely. Even Tony Blair's advisors in the Foreign Office were telling him that to actually join American bombing Iraq would put England on the front line for terrorist attack and make it a target rather than the reverse, which is what Blair is. It's so stark, staring, obvious. It's amazing. It has to be spelled out. I kind of feel a lot with the columns I was writing that I was just saying the obvious, really. And it seems funny when you say the obvious, but the press isn't saying it.
What's the view of George W. Bush in Great Britain?
I don't know. I can't really speak for everybody. I can give you my opinion, which is that I'm sure George Bush is a very companionable guy, somebody you'd get on well with, behind the locker rooms and having a quiet fag with him after school, things like that. But I don't think it's him that's running the country. I think he's just a very pliable figurehead for Cheney, Rumsfeld, Richard Pearl, Paul Wolfowitz, all those shadowy figures who populate the White House and the Pentagon now, and who are running the show, basically, and they're calling the tunes. And I think those are the sinister characters.
You have an election coming up in Britain. What are the prospects for Tony Blair, and how much of his policies on Iraq and alliance with George W. Bush, how much negativity do you think is going to accrue to him in the polls for his decisions?
Well, I think there's a lot of negativity in thinking people and in intelligent people and intelligent members of the Labour Party. I think there's a big resentment there, and I think a lot of people who will just not vote for him. Speaking personally, I will just not vote for the man. And I think his credibility as a truthful statesman has been totally undermined by the pack of lies he told and the spin he gave to the dodgy dossier and to stampeding people into believing that we had to bomb Iraq, that Iraq was a threat. I think he's lost a lot of credibility there, and I think one can see how much he knows he's lost by the fact that he tries to ignore the fact he doesn't want to talk about Iraq. Oh, that's all over and done with. The Labour Party are desperate to try and put other things on the agenda, and of course the press is very complacent and compliant and talks about other things rather than the key thing, the fact that he took our country to war on false pretenses, and a lot of people, 100,000 Iraqis, have died as a result of it, and I think it's an absolute abomination.
Terry Jones, in conclusion here, certainly the landscape of the world, our two nations, Britain and the United States, is quite bleak these days. Do you take some hope that there'll be some change in the near to not to distant future in terms of our politics, in terms of our foreign policies, in terms of making an effort for peace in the world?
Yeah, I think the only hope is with you, really, with the American public, waking up to the true nature of the guys who are running the show at the moment, and the true nature of the Rumsfeld and Cheney and Pearl and Wolfowitz. It's only when the word gets around about who they are and what they're up to it's up to Americans, the American public, to actually get them out of office and and get the more reasonable set of people in power. It's going to be a tough one, but I hope they can do it. But I hope it happens. But it's, I think the ball's in your court.
That was Terry Jones, columnist, author, and founding member of the Monty Python comedy troupe. His latest book, Terry Jones's War on the War on Terror, is published by Nation Books. Sister Helen Prejean is one of the country's best-known and most passionate opponents of the death penalty. She has been speaking out since the early 1980s, when she accompanied convicted murderer Patrick Saunier to his execution by electrocution. She wrote the book Dead Man Walking about her experience, which later became an Academy Award-winning movie with Susan Sarandon playing Prejean in the leading role. Sister Prejean spoke earlier this month at Yale University's Catholic Chapel, where she made reference to Connecticut's death penalty law, which was recently challenged and debated in the state legislature, though the law authorizing execution by lethal injection was not abolished. Serial rapist and murderer Michael Ross will be executed in Connecticut on May 11th, unless a federal judge rules in the next few weeks that he was incompetent to waive his remaining appeals and choose to die. This would mark the first execution in all of New England in 45 years. Sister Prejean's talk at Yale followed a recent report in Britain's top medical journal, The Lancet, which argued that some prisoners executed by lethal injection may feel extreme pain because they are improperly sedated as they are put to death.
When I came out of the execution chamber on the night of April the 5th, 1984, I had just watched a man be put to death in front of my eyes. Patrick Saunier. I had been asked to write letters to him when I began working among people in the inner city, and I really thought all I was ever going to do would be to write letters. So much for the sneakiness of God, part one. I never dreamed Louisiana was going to kill him. It was 1982. We hadn't killed anyone since the 60s. The whole country had had a moratorium on the death penalty. I thought I was only going to be writing letters. And then I accompanied him and found myself, as he said to me right before, and he was to be electrocuted to death in the electric chair, saying to me, "No, Sister Helen, you can't be there at the end because it could scar you psychologically to see this. Just pray that God holds up my legs." And I found myself saying to him, "No, Pat, there's no way you're going to die alone without a loving face to see. You look at me. And I will be the face of love. I'll be the face of Christ for you." And right before they put the mask on him, the mask when they electrocute someone is to protect the witnesses so they can't see what happens to a human face when 1,900 volts of electricity would be passed through his body. He caught my eye there with the witnesses. And I carry his face inside of me. I walked out, it was the middle of the night, having just watched someone who was alive, who was talking to me, and then who was walked down the hall and was killed. And I threw up, and I remember thinking it was dark. The polls in Louisiana said everybody thought the death penalty was a fine idea. I had been drawn in as a witness, and I remember thinking, you know, the people of Louisiana are never going to see this. It's almost a secret ritual. And I thought that at that moment, and I've followed it ever since, I got to tell the story. I've been the witness. I got to be the one to bring people close to this and to talk about the death penalty. And I began to do that right after. If you put me on Google, I'm known as a death penalty nun. That's how you draw me up on Google. Real Christianity stretches us. Cultural Christianity, Christianity light. You don't have to be stretched. Just say an eye for an eye, and you're in there with all the rest and for the death penalty, right? You don't have to reflect. You don't have to dig. You don't have to deal with this huge ambivalence that most of us struggle with over the death penalty, the outrage over the death of innocent people that we hear about, and then the part of our hearts that knows you can barely trust the government to fill the potholes, right? Much less have a system whereby we're going to select who lives and who dies in our state. Please. I mean, the only reason you in Connecticut are faced with the death penalty is because you have somebody that wants the state to help him end his own life because he's had enough of it. To think that we have come to a point in this society that we actually say, and the language of the Supreme Court of the United States when they put the death penalty back in the Gregg decision has language that says executions are not against the dignity of the human person, even though life imprisonment is available. And there are some crimes so morally outrageous that only death will suffice. What kind of language is that? To have politicians or to have prosecutors say to the victims' families who are undergoing grief and confusion and loss and outrage, we're going to heal you. We're going to offer you something in this society now. We're going to go for the death penalty because that's the only way we really show honor and respect for your dead loved one. The way, and you hear language sometimes at trial, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, we so respect life in this society. And look, this poor woman has been killed. Look, her parents are sitting there. Look at their grief. They'll never see their daughter graduate from college. They'll never see their grandchildren. The way that we show respect for life, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, is I want you to ask you to stiffen your backbone, bite the bullet, and do the tough thing, which is to give the death penalty, and then to promise to the victim's family. Now, you wait 10, 15, 17 years, and we'll summon you one day, and you come sit on the front row, and you watch as we kill the one who killed your loved one, and that will heal your heart. That will give dignity to your loved one who has been lost. That will honor their life. And people like murder victims' families for reconciliation, for human rights in this country, stand before us. They come to judicial hearings at state legislatures, and they say, don't kill for me. Don't say we're going to honor the life of my loved one by now you, the state, going through this protocol, premeditated death of a human being.
That was death penalty opponent Sister Helen Prejean speaking at Yale University in early April. For more information on the nuns' campaign against the death penalty, call area code 504-948-6557 or visit her website at www.prejean.org. Prejean's talk was recorded and produced by Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There, you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anon, Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.